engaged in at the moment. We also need short-term memory. And CityPlan has found that other technologies, other than computers, although related to them, have this quality, because you're dealing with more ethereal messages, with messages that are not stored, such as the text messages that we can find in cellular telephones. And she has found specific uses that migrating communities make of cell phones. It should be a rather obvious thing, since sometimes that's the only way they can connect with their motherland or with the family they left behind. But beyond that, she has found the cell phone as a useful image to deal with the kind of knitting together of communities that a cell phone can do. And extended the metaphor to talk about actual knitting. And indeed, I would not even think it is a metaphor altogether. As you probably are aware, the very first use of software in industry was indeed a weaving machine. The patterns that get weaved into a particular textile where a punch as holes in wooden cards that then were read by a controlling device that transformed it into movements of the loom. And although knitting is quite different than weaving, as she's going to tell us briefly, the idea that textiles constitute a space with certain characteristics, and that those characteristics can be detached from the textiles themselves and move to other substrata, other mediums that can carry the same patterns. Well, of course, that idea echoes many of the things that we were talking about yesterday about topological forms being actualized in a wide diversity of actual forms, or this morning with Brian's lecture as to perceptual patterns such as lunging that can be also perceived in completely different rhythms, as he was calling them, rhythms that can be detached from their material vehicles and seen instantiated in different parts. Well, so is the space of textiles in different ways. We can not only metaphorize about it, but indeed detach a certain topological aspect of them and find isomorphisms, deeper isomorphisms than just metaphors or analogies between the different spaces. So I'm going to leave that as an introduction. Sadie is going to give us a wonderful presentation about this. All I have to say about her, she's not at the time teaching anywhere, and I just want to mention the three wonderful books that she's written. The Most Radical Gesture, that's the first one. Then another one on questions of feminism and digital culture called Zeros and Ones. And the last one called Writing on Drugs. So please help me welcome Sadie Plank.
Words and all their resonances, of course, become one's prime raw material. without wanting, I'm not at all making some big point here about the status of language or the significance of words and terminology and so on, but it just seems a shame to use words like meeting without taking full advantage of the incredibly rich resource that this one term like that can open up historically, etymologically, mythologically, and in all sorts of resonances, which in particular sort of individuals as well. So our words are really rich resources. They carry, if you like, implicit, tacit kind of archives in themselves, and that's the prime reason why I'd like to really take this terminology seriously. So what I'd like to do is to knit this notion of knitting together with mobile wireless communications, primarily the humble mobile phone, although I will be talking more generally about far more sophisticated wireless futures as well. Obviously, in relation to the question of archiving and the keeping of records and history and so on, many aspects of the mobile phone and the ways in which it is used seem to be escaping the archives, if you like. Most of the messages that are sent are very transient, they're very contingent, they're passing messages. They tend not to be recorded. People don't keep them, even though, of course, one can say it's technically possible to do so by transferring them to another medium. But on the face of it, they could really seem to lend themselves more to forgetting, you could say, than to memory. They just simply pass through our lives. Now, obviously, this may not be, and probably is not true at all, on the level of the slate. I'm really talking about this in terms of one's own personal experience of these messages. In these days of where we seem to be having to all collaborate to project the security of some other homeland somewhere across the Atlantic, then clearly we're looking at a situation where potentially all of our text messages, all of our voice calls are in fact stored and searched and archived and databased on massive computers somewhere totally out of our reach. So I'm not at all suggesting that we're looking at some unarchivable system here, but simply that people's everyday experience of it is that it is non-archived. And of course, just on this more sinister kind of side of mobile phone tracking and the keeping of information, obviously we've already seen many cases all over the world of people being arrested or even assassinated by simply using a mobile phone. This is, of course, by definition, a tracking device. So even in this sense, one's kind of leaving an archive of one's movements as well as the messages and calls and so on that are sent using it. There are even more nightmarish possibilities as well as this notion of cellular, of using the network of mobile phone masts as a kind of radar surveillance system, which opens up all sorts of absolutely horrific security questions. But I suppose the fact that mobile communications have these kind of two sides, on the one hand, very anonymous and very ephemeral and fleeting, on the other side, potentially infinitely recordable, is rather like the issue of archiving in relation to all digital communications and all digital technologies. In one sense, digitalisation seems to open up the possibility of limitless archiving, of being limited, increasingly more and more information, more and more levels of information, I would say, the sense that the archive can grow and grow, become more dynamic, more complete in terms of large quotation marks. On the other hand, there seems to be that digital archiving almost threatens the possibility of keeping anything at all. You know, we talk to many librarians about the issues involved in archiving material in the present moment. Then their big fear is constantly that things are getting lost and that information needs to be constantly updated, migrated into new systems, and that in fact digitization opens up new possibilities of losing information. So maybe mobile communications really speaks to both ends of that particular spectrum. But certainly, as I say, in prosaic terms, the mobile phone still seems to offer the possibility of a certain level of anonymity and a certain sense in which one's movements and messages are not being archived, at least in one's private life. Just simple examples, the very fact that phone messages to teenagers, for example, always, of course, used to come through the parents or the people who own a phone and have a phone bill to pay. Now those messages tend not to come through intermediaries. We're living in a time of much more direct and therefore potentially anonymous immediate communication. Therefore, again, on this individual level, I suppose this allows mobile communications to participate Walter on called the essential effervescence for formal communication. That really these are sounds or messages that only exist, as he said, when they're going out of existence. So in this sense that they're very direct, interpersonal, immediate, that they messages often rely on very specific, local, shared cultural assumptions, very local cultures or local codes, which move very quickly. The sort of rapid, spontaneous inventions and mutations of language, like you see, for example, in text messaging and so on. In all these ways, even text messages, although they're written, they behave much more like acts of speech than they do written text. Of course, this doesn't really signify some kind of return to oral culture, because we're not living in an oral world at all. It's merely one strand that makes many, many different means of communication that we have. But nevertheless, it is true. That mobile messages are immediate, they're short-term, they're made and read and often responded to as quickly as they travel. They're often composed and received and transmitted with very little thought and very little consequence. And, of course, these really are not messages made to last. You know, if you want a communication to last, you're not going to send it as a text message. They belong to this kind of social world which involves very flexible lives, for example, sudden changes of plan, the sense that everything's contingent, everything can be changed in a moment, last minute approximate arrangements can be made, or else they belong to the realm of gestures, the little haptic gestures, really digital squeezes of the hand, if you like, small expressions of affection. Again, exactly the kind of thing that in a pre-digital age has never been archived in the ordinary sense of understanding the term archive. So my first question when I started really addressing this way back last year for this conference is what's left of such communications once they fade away or once they're erased, once you press the delete button, your text message, what happens to it? Is the absence of an archive in this sense necessarily to the detriment of our personal memories, our senses of our own past, or our collective histories? Does it even matter that we don't keep any records? That we have no archives of these messages or the links, the relationships, even the people with whom we were making contact. Now you could of course say, and it would be true, that in many ways this situation already arose over 100 years ago with the advent of the telephone. That was really the time when we had an explosion of these new kinds of messages, these kinds of messages that weren't any longer being recorded. You know, before that, things would have been passed. They would have left their calling card, which is very archivable. They would have sent postcards, telegrams. All of these have a different kind of life to a telephone conversation or a telephone message. So at the end of the 19th century, or when telephone begins to really explode in the early 20th century, there is a corresponding explosion of messages. Now, some of them are substituting for things that were once written down, letters, postcards, and so on. Others are kind of substituting for face-to-face communication. People speak on the phone instead of meeting directly. But most of them, presumably, were quite new. This really was a new medium, and therefore opened up a new block of messages, if you like, a new kind of messages, that wasn't really just substituting from old times. It was a new kind of communication in itself. Now, at that moment, of course, and Herbert Castle famously ties the explosion of the telephone in that period with the great organisation of cities, as he refers to it, and of a certain kind of social life within these new concentrations, these new urban concentrations in the early 20th century. Now we can see this almost happening again as a second kind of telephone moment, if you like, in relation to the mobile phone. Only this time, I think, it's not about the consolidation, organisation of cities. In fact, it's about a new sense of mobility, and this really does, of course, tie in, as Manuel suggested with Arjun's presentation this morning. Obviously, if we are looking at a world of increasingly mobile populations, and I'll come back to this in a moment in more detail, this obviously doesn't suit an infrastructure of fixed, geographically fixed, stable lines and connections. There is, if you like, a new need for a sense of direct mobile communication between mobile individuals. And I think it really is true, although it can sound very trite to say, but it is nevertheless even statistically true, and it certainly feels true, to say that we are living in times of unprecedented movement, not just in terms of tourism, business travel, you know, all of those Western ways of living around the world. But if you look at a country like China, for example, at this very moment, it's probably facing movements that are on historically unprecedented scale, with people moving from rural areas into the city. So talking about movements that we probably here find the most incomprehensible in terms of their scale. China is, of course, one of the countries, or the leading consumer of mobile phones at the moment, even though I think under 10% of the Chinese population actually own a mobile phone. They are, in fact, the world's leading market, so to speak. And we can see that kind of phenomenon happening all over the world. And as has already been suggested today, in seeing that kind of movement, obviously we're seeing great dislocations, great disruptions happening. And in fact, in China, these are even more marked by the fact that, remember, since they've had this one-child policy for the last, 28 years, I think, or something, it is now, then obviously almost everybody under the age of 30, let's say, who is a round number, is an only child, and therefore has no brothers, no sisters. Increasingly, younger generations have no aunts, uncles, cousins, etc. You can imagine the whole notion of what a family is has undergone this incredible upheaval. Now, this kind of movement that I'm talking about to the cities would obviously be dramatic enough in normal circumstances, but when families only have one child, and that one child goes from Wales to the local rural area to Beijing, for example, then, of course, you know, you're losing the most precious asset. And new ways of keeping in touch, new practical, ordinary, everyday, prosaic ways of making contact, obviously become increasingly important in those circumstances. So you really see the mobile phone being used in China as a way of maintaining these incredibly fragile, precious links between the only child, the family that they've left behind, off in the remote countryside, where of course there would normally have been no telecommunications infrastructure at all without mobile telephony. No electricity perhaps, and certainly no telephony. So people are often using this technology to maintain links that have been lost. Likewise, of course, they're often using the technology to establish new connections as well when they get to the other end. All of these lonely, only children who collide in Beijing are obviously using mobile technology to establish themselves, to establish new social networks and so on. And we don't have to look, of course, to China to see this happening. In the West, of course, we've got many people using the technology in exactly these ways, and again, very much as Arjun suggested this morning, in terms of the use of the net, although I, of course, would suggest that mobile phones have become perhaps more significant in this respect recently. But certainly just down the road from where I live in Birmingham in England, there's a huge hostel for asylum seekers. And nearly all of them using mobile phones, again, both to maintain or re-establish lost connections, but also to try and to establish themselves in their new environment, as well as keeping themselves in touch with the old one. And again, these are people who, not so long ago, how would you ever have got a telephone number? I mean, in a country like the UK, even now, you need a fixed address, you need credit rating, a bank account. I mean, you need so many kind of social accoutrements, if you like, before you can even get close to getting a telephone. It would take you years if you ever made it. Whereas now, of course, in principle, you can just walk into a shop and purchase the thing, and then you do have a number. You've got that establishment immediately. So it's a very practical difference. And on this line of making new connections, you can see that the mobile phone in many unlikely parts of the world, and in ways which are quite contrary to, of course, all the ways in which the mobile phone has ever been marketed and promoted by the corporations, I should say as an aside. But you can see it being used, again, to establish very new kinds of connections, which may not sound very dramatic or significant to us, but on the ground, if you like, can make an enormous difference, again, especially in the context for people who've never had access to technologies of telecommunication before. Often, for example, people are using these technologies, because they are so direct and personal, to really get rid of the middleman, who often, of course, is the bane of every small-scale trader's life all around the world. And I've spoken, whilst doing this research, to you know, a whole range of people who tell a very similar story about being able to cut out all these endless intermediaries that, of course, you know, constantly cream off the conflicts and so on in one's life. From, for example, go-go dancers in Bangkok who have started to be able to organise their own appointments without use going through the pink system that obviously keeps the whole thing under control in a city like Bangkok. Farmers on the Ivory Coast are using mobile phones to check wholesale commodity prices. So again, they're not just simply having to take the nearest dealer's word for, you know, what things are really worth. Somali traders who are moving up and down the East African coast are using mobile phones to coordinate their movements, find out what other goods are doing, where things can be sold and so on. So I'm very interested in that kind of economic grassroots impact that mobile technology can have. We're also obviously seeing great potential with the kind of political mobility with the mobile phone as well. It's using physical demonstrations over the last few weeks, of course, have, you know, really come into its own in that respect alone. 2 years ago, when the Estrada government fell in the Philippines, this was called the texting revolution by much of the mainstream media. But they were looking at another serious point, which was that, again, Philippines, whilst not having a large number of mobile phones, certainly had a vast usage of that technology and used it in very politicised ways in order to bring people together for demonstrations or just simply spread news about what's happening. And there's also a kind of psychological mobility, and perhaps this is more relevant to the developed world. You see, for example, in Tokyo, and of course increasingly in many parts of the whole developed world, people using mobile phones to coordinate almost every aspect of their social lives, from navigating the city space to fine-tuning arrangements to meet, often to meet people that they've also met through the mobile phone. Now, these kinds of uses of mobile technology represent subtle but pervasive changes to the practice of everyday life and people's perceptions of themselves and the space that they occupy, the networks which they're part of. And, for example, in Japan, which was, of course, a very highly ritualized, very formal culture in many ways, if you make an appointment in Japan, you know, it really is made, or it was made and fixed, and you have to be on time. It's extremely society. But now there's a new attitude to this kind of arrangement. It's all very loose and flexible. You make a vague arrangement to meet next week, and when next week comes, it gradually gets more and more honed down, almost until the very moment that you actually come together, when this sort of virtual meeting starts to become actualized in the moment. Now, obviously, this kind of connectivity, if you like, can also produce a sense of dislocation, which is why I think you hear people constantly, usually on trains, which is the environment everybody loves to hate mobile phones in, having these kinds of what I would call location conversations, where people say, for example, where are you? You know, it's a great thing. People always want to pin you down when you're on the mobile phone. Where are you? To relocate you in this kind of dislocated environment. And of course, the classic answers are either I'm on the train, which of course doesn't answer question of where I am, or better still, I'm on the mobile. But certainly everybody, I mean, what you're locating, of course, is not the geographical place, you're locating the person. What you've got is almost a number for the person. It's a very immediate, direct, almost one could say intimate kind of technology, because it's really carried on the body, or you know, very close to the body, anyway. And in fact, this is, I would suggest, the first piece of technology after many, many years of speculating about this kind of thing. But it really is the first piece of technology that we've started as a mass of people all over the world to wear. It's the first piece of technology that really is becoming like our clothing. It really is operating in ways which have been often talked about in very metaphorical and poetic terms from McLuhan onwards, as a kind of second skin. And very much like clothing, it has an impact on our behavior and on our perceptions of ourselves and on our appearance and so on to the outside world. So I would suggest that the mobile would be great for ordinary people. I mean, this is the beauty of this. We're not just talking about an avant-garde somewhere, either of artists or technicians. But for a vast mass of people in the world, it's really becoming a kind of evolution of our clothing, of our skin, of this interface between the body and the world. wireless is really making, is really introducing a new set of possibilities of interconnected individuals, new kinds of networks between mobile points rather than a fixed web terminal. You can see this actually in operation in a very interesting way. The game being coordinated this week by Glass Theory as part of the spectacle, Can You See Me Now? That's a game that really does take advantage of mobile technologies, wireless technologies, operating in effect as clothing, as an interface. Unlike the internet, which is very much something that you tend to access in a private space behind closed doors, mobile technologies are not only used in public domain, but they're seen to be used as well. So it's the first time that we've really had this sort of performative aspect of the technology again. And that sort of underlines the fact that it's operating as an interface. So the mobile is really the first technological device to be really used as this constant accessory and effectively worn as a garment, adopted almost as commonly and as automatically as clothing. And it's because of this portability that mobile communications don't operate in some exclusive virtual domain. Instead, they're in this constant interaction with geographical mobility. So it's really bringing the body into play, I would suggest. We're looking at technology in the context of the body. And the character of the interface is very specific to this relationship to the evolution of clothing, which by extension, in clearance terms, will be seen as itself an evolution of the skin, clothing as a kind of second skin. And of course, skin, like clothing, serves many different functions. These interfaces are multifunctional themselves. It's both a matter, for example, of protection and also communication. It's about survival, you know, protection in that sense. But it's also about adornment and ornamentation. It's about protecting the body, but it's also about projecting something about the body outside as well. So in all these respects, it really is an interface. It's a connection with the world, and it's a dividing line between you and the world as well. And I'm very struck by the endurance of clothing, textiles, imagery in not only the last couple of days, in fact, obviously this whole festival, but also all of the areas around digital art and technologies. I mean, obviously we've got the classic example of the World Wide Web. The web, and web, of course, is a technical term really for a woven product. But at this festival alone, if you look at the workshops and events and so on, and we've not only got this broad theme of data knitting, there's a workshop called Media Knitting, there's another one called Data Quilting. Billy Mass just now was referring to tapestries of production. The motifs and the imagery, key surfacing of textiles and fabrics and clothing. And this is also true in relation to this other area of memory and archiving as well. All the way through, not only Western imagery and Western mythology, but you can find constant references to textiles and textile production in relation to these ideas of archiving, memory, what's kept and what's lost. It seems that there's something about textile art which always comes back to this, maybe some notion about the threads of memory and so on. And of course, often textiles really are imbued with living memory, either from their production or indeed, of course, their use. You know, people have very personal memories associated with particular fabrics and so on. And of course, this is why patchwork is such a wonderful expression of a collective memory. And if you donate various bits of fabric, the dress they got married in, or whatever it might be, and the whole thing gets put together into a new collective memory, in effect. But even in terms of abstract patterns, actually, you know, woven into cloth, for example, and in the representation of designs, there's a whole history of meaning encoded in that kind of the history of textile production. you can see this in an especially rich form in the Islamic tradition of carpet production, for example, because that's also based on garden design and so on. But because of the Islamic concern about the dangers of representational art, they tend to obviously get a lot of creative activity sunk into abstract art, and you get these incredibly beautiful symmetrical designs, which do in fact operate as kind of encoded information in the form of, for example, the carpet. Although I should just mention that, of course, they always include a mistake there is no Islamic carving or miniature painting or whatever it might format it might say without an error, because they do of course believe that only Allah can make everything perfect, and so if man has made it, then it has to have an error in it somewhere. So if you've got a carpet and you think there's a mistake in it, then it's a deliberate mistake. Anyway, now as Manuel said, the role of weaving in particular in this whole story is not at all metaphorical. And I don't want to talk too much about this now, because I have talked about it over the years many, many times, and I'm sure you've all read it and heard it before. But nevertheless, in the history of computing, just very, very briefly, certainly this is where weaving has far more than a metaphorical role to play. The Jacquard loom, which is the device Manuel was referring to in his introduction, was really one of the most advanced pieces of technology at the beginning of the 19th century. And this was in effect, the first programmable machine, one can say, looking back with hindsight, with the ability to see what programmable would become. But effectively, it did allow for the weaving, automatic weaving of designs which were to be programmed into the system. And of course, Jacquard looms are still used to produce very ornate textiles patterns. And obviously, the whole role of textiles in the Industrial Revolution in terms of their actual production as well, and not just in terms of this specific history in relation to the history of the computer, is very crucial. It was this technology, the Jacquard loom, that Ada Lovelace and Charles Babbage first picked up on when, in the, again, early period of the 19th century, they began to see the potential for what they called an analytical engine, which we would call a computer, as literally an abstract weaving machine. Ada Lovelace talked about the computer weaving algebraic formula in exactly the same way that the Jacquard loom had woven its patterns of flowers and leaves and the designs on the cloth, in the cloth. So that's, of course, a very fascinating story about weaving. But if you want a really close fitting interface for the body, weaving is actually not so useful. If you want a real second skin in a practical, technical sense, then you need far more flexibility. And this is where knitting really comes into its own. And knitting itself, of course, is a wonderful repository of memory in the same way as things like Islamic carpets. If you look at especially the Scandinavian countries and the northern islands of Scotland, Faroe, for example, you find these incredibly detailed, colourful patterns, all of which are usually very specific to particular knitters or particular traditions or particular communities, local communities. On the Isle of Arran, where they have only single coloured garments knitted by hand, all of the designs in the texture of the garment rather than different colours. But in that case, the patterns that are encoded in the jumpers, again, relate to very local communities, in specific parts of villages. This is because they're worn by sailors. If the sailors drown, or are lost at sea, or not lost at sea, I suppose ultimately found at sea, wearing their jumpers, their knitted garments, then they can be identified to the village they came from by the pattern of jumper that they're wearing. So this kind of encoding of memory really has often historically served a very specific practical purpose. But what's really distinctive about knitting as opposed to weaving and many other forms of textile is that knitting is really just one big series of loops. In fact, you could almost describe it as one very big loose knot, a piece of knitted fabric. And it's this process of looping, whereas of course weaving is a grid, a very striated thing, one could say. But it's this process of looping that really gives the finished fabric its elasticity, its kind of give, its flexibility. It's what allows it to really fit the body. It's a kind of stretch fabric, by definition, because of this technique of a succession of loops. And in fact, it's thought that socks were the oldest, that the first things to be made through this technique of knitting. And obviously the foot is a very peculiar thing to wrap in a cloth if it's not a very flexible cloth. You can imagine that woven cloth isn't very useful for making the socks out of. So you really do need this kind of bodily hug, this flexibility, this close fit to make socks. And the oldest examples of knitting to have survived were in fact preserved as you, if you have ever muted something in the company of a cat, you'll know that this can happen to the cat stay. In a matter of moments, the whole thing is gone. It's also a technique which is often done by people, traditionally at least, in a semi-automatic way. In fact, Freud and Breuer, in their always interesting source book on hysteria, so to speak, picks up on knitting as one of the main processes that hysterics tend to do. Because they can be performed, as they said, by many people with only half their minds on it. And of course, you know, it's easy to laugh at Freud, but this really is a very true point, in that people do knit whilst reading books, watching TV, walking along the street. I mean, there's almost no limit to what you, well, of course, that's the thing, there are many limits. But the point is that while weaving is a very fixed task, knitting is literally very mobile. It really can be picked up and put down. It's not something you have to think, right, now I'm going to sit and knit. I mean, this is the point I'm trying to make. And historically, many refer to the fact that that knitting has this sense of mobility. For example, this notion that you can take a walk, you can knit as you're going. The English Dales, which is one area of England very famous for hand knitting, it was said in the 19th century, the woman knits when her household work is done, the man when he's out of work, his door work is done. As they walk about in their garden or go from one village to another, the process is going on. And it was also observed that people would knit walking, talking, or begging without hardly ever looking at their work. So this is the, you know, give this impression that you can do it along with many other things. So if you'd like, what are we looking at here with knitting? It's a flexible, contingent, mobile second skin. It's cheaply produced, almost automatically produced, by people who barely need to think about a task that really fits seamlessly into their life. Their bodies, their fingers are engaged in almost without thinking about it. Now that's a description of knitting, but I would also suggest that it's really our experience of data in the age of the mobile phone. Now the thing about knitting is that it's left hardly any archives. I've mentioned the socks in Arabia, but they really are extremely, that's about the only thing that has survived, you know, from antiquity, as you might say. This is true with, to some extent, with all textiles. Nearly all textiles tend to drop out of our official histories. Partly because, for example, archaeologists always used to throw the textiles away because they find things wrapped up in textiles and they think, oh, what's this? It's a pot. And they throw the pot away, where it's often the cloth which really contains so much of the information that really is holding it, often as a pattern or some kind of code. So a lot of it has literally been overlooked in that very prosaic and watery way. But the thing about knitting in particular is that it's nearly always been used to make garments, such as socks, and which remains, in fact, you know, one of its prime uses, even in the machine age. And garments like that are made to be worn, and they are made to be worn out. You know, again, they're not made to be kept. There's no intention when you produce something, knitted production, it lasts. You're not making the buyer tapestry to last forever. So the garments, and of course even increasingly, the skills tend to die out as well. The memories of all these patterns of the Bear Isles and the Isle of Arran and so on. So again, the question, what happens to all these processes, these patterns, the social functions involved in knitting, all the activities associated with it? Do they just disappear and become irretrievable somehow? Or are they in fact examples of things which may not make it into the archives as explicit data, but are nevertheless no less significant than that? It seems to me that the patterns and the processes, even the meanings often, seem to sort of migrate, becoming part of the material history of a new set of relationships, possibly a new set of techniques or technology. They may appear to leave no traces, they may be literally overlooked and passed by. But of course, that doesn't mean that they don't matter. I want to suggest that they end up being somehow implicit or tacit. In fact, this perhaps brings us back to Brian Massini's fascinating talk this morning. they perhaps end up being implicit in the technologies of the present. I was really impressed by Simon Conway Morris's comment yesterday, in fact, to look at this slide he had of the, I don't know if you're still here, Simon, but anyway, the cliff in Dorset. And he pointed out that 90% of time is somehow unregistered on this. But obviously, of course, you can't say that 90% is therefore irrelevant. Without that 90%, the time of the event would never have happened. But I do think it's a significant point that as the possibility of archiving extends, we all have to be careful, perhaps, that we don't make the mistake of thinking that our archives are complete in the sense that what we see is what's actually all that's there. And just for a moment to look at what is documented in the history of missing, because obviously I don't want to suggest that it doesn't have any kind of archive at all. I've already mentioned these Arab socks, and after that, really much of the 20th century popularity of missing, and all its, most of the full records, as well indeed as its very inaccurate characterisation of women's work, because this really is a case of technology that has become associated with women, but is not in fact a female technology. It all goes back to the First World War, when women who were left behind at home were encouraged to knit socks and hats and gloves for their men on the front lines. In fact, the slogan was, "Our boys need socks, knit your bit." And I was very interested to see that this has quite bizarre, really, given that we're now living in a different era, but it has its an updated version. This happened in World War I, it happened in World War II. Now it's happening in what I fear may become World War III. There's now a project for the troops of Operation Enduring Freedom. That's, of course, we must remember this adventure we're embarked upon is called, which has already knitted 35,000 pairs of socks and hats and so on for the troops serving in the Gulf. I worked out there's a quarter of a million of them there. They've only got another 215,000 pairs of socks to make. To get on with. Now, at the time of the First World War, the soldiers who received these items obviously didn't really want socks to come. These two, rather like text messages that sent, I would suggest, and I really forgot to speed up, so I'm really running out of time, but I'd like to make a few points here. These were really gestures of affection. They were sent as, in fact, the slogan that's used today for the current campaign to get American women to knit socks for the boys on the front is to send a hope from home. Yeah, so the point is not really to provide garments. Again, it's a transient, ephemeral kind of message, a gesture of affection. And the soldiers who received them used to joke about it because they were often really badly made. They couldn't knit, of course. There's all sorts of funny parts showing them sitting in the trenches in the First World War with one sock on the head, close knit in another one. But they used to joke about these knitted boots being lumps of air with all around, rather than this. That's how useless they thought of them. But in fact, this leads me on to a really useful connection. Because these lumps of air with wool around are in fact what gives knitted goods their heat collecting qualities and makes them warm, which is why we all still wear them. It's a way of trapping heat in those holes, those loops that knitting makes. This really is a bad way of clothing works. By extension, you just trap a layer of air between you and your clothing in order to keep warm. And in exactly picking up on this idea, this is where we see these kind of migrations happening. This is now becoming the basis for wearable electronics. When I talk about wearable electronics, I mean chips, for example, sewn or woven into clothing, or even increasingly clothing woven from conductive threads. Or for example, woven textile circuits, so you can actually just weave or embroider a circuit on a fabric. So it seems to me that our portable mobile technologies really are very literally converging with this history of textile production and that knitting in particular. So again, these are all great sophistications of clothing, of this very basic interface between the body and its environment, which effectively is coming through time and turning itself into something quite different. Now, I'd just like to end, if I may, with perhaps a way in which we can think about this. Oh, well, actually, I've just got two things to point out. One is that one of the fascinating things about thinking about knitting in terms of an archive or kind of even a lost archive can perhaps talk about the vocabulary later, is the fact that we tend to overlook it because it's still all around us, and in fact textiles generally, you know, it's so obvious we don't think about it. Even this room with clothes, one might say, with curtains and drapings and so on. And I bet there's barely a person, if anybody here, who is not wearing some knitted garment of some kind. I mean, I don't mean necessarily hand-knitted, of course, but these processes have obviously historically migrated from hand products to machine, and now increasingly into this kind of smart fabrics, which is, I think, the future of the mobile phone, the ordinary mobile phone itself, the mobile technology. And as I say, there's no limit to what you can do with knitting. And last night, I found this poor electronic rabbit who was trying to run away from the street seller who was selling it, and I just couldn't resist buying him to bring him to the street. And he's knitting. It's another example. I mean, to me, this is the equivalent in archive in terms of a pair of socks. Now, who is going to archive this kind of thing? It's made to be worn out, made to be used. I'm amazed that it works. Of course, we only have a few minutes of life. So not only is the adorable thing knitted, but it's also a classic case, just like these things I've been talking about, the sort of thing that slips out of the archive. I guess this one, of course, has made it into the archive now, since it's been broadcast at my speed all around the world, online. He's the one who survived. I guess it will be an example of many things that the future will not know about the French.
The hero.
If I can just say with a quick quotation from Rodel, the French historian, who says, "It's patient and monotonous efforts which tend to lead technology forward." Technology, he says, is not only a matter of the brisk changes that we are a little too quick to label as revolutions, but also slow improvements in processes and tools. There's innumerable actions which certainly have no innovating significance, but which are the fruit of accumulating knowledge. The sailor fixing his ropes, the miner digging his gallery, the peasant behind his plough, the smith at the anvil, etc. And he talks about these as the technicians of the world, drawing on what he calls techniques that are more akin to a collection of recipes. And in fact, the word recipe is the term, the old term that was used for knitting patterns, as in the diagrams and the instructions that people follow to produce knitted garments. That's actually the term that was used. Now, I would suggest that knitting, and obviously a thousand and one other activities, belong in Rodel's list. This kind of careful repetitions, it's like the background hum of activity, the sort of short-term living memory, the background noise, maybe we could say, of the archive in the more explicit sense, but this implicit tacit archive that make those explicit archives possible, in fact. And maybe this is also where the mobile communications at the moment belong as well, as a living and always dying, consequently, archive of messages, of links, of networks, of codes, patterns of behaviour, and so on. Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
successful in there, and it's the whole tendency works against the notion of punctual time, where linear time is quite present as points on a line that succeed one another, because there's always a sort of folding in and folding back of time, so that the smallest unit is already continuity that implies a duration, at least virtually. The way that comes out in relation, for example, to Stern, there's a really interesting passage where he talks about these amodal perceptions, these activation contours, and he says that they arise as a kind of deja vu, even the very first time, because when the link is made, when there's a similarity that's experienced, it sort of grabs you and brings you into this non-local proximity to a process. When that happens, it's sort of kind of like an echo, and there's a sensation of familiarity. So that the pastness is part of that present moment. You can't just separate the present from the past. And at the same time, because it's affective, there's always a desire implied, because if it's, for example, soothing, it implies an anticipation of the next soothing, or a desire for the next one. So it's like a little weaving together of dimensions of time that constitutes the present as a duration, as a continuity. And the future element is important because it sort of opens the whole system. It introduces desire and openness about that's still perhaps toward repetition, but it opens it up to novelty in a way. So the attempt is to try to find all of those things, pastness and futurity, openness and different forms of determination right there in the immediate perception, immediate impression.
I want to add something just to explain this to everybody. Affect in Deleuze does not always refer to feelings, to affectivity in our psychic life, but refers to any capacity by anything, metals and wood and plants, to affect and be affected. So ways of kind of giving a perceptuality or consciousness or awareness to everything about it, just humans. And it leads to ethics in a very simple way, because given two things that can affect and be affected by one another, we can ask, are they affecting each other so as to enhance one another's powers? Or are they affecting each other so as to are they poisons or are they food, nourishment? And this leads very straight to a kind of environmental type ethics in which a little bit of phosphorus nourishes the land. Too much phosphorus poisons the land. So it's not good and evil. It's a matter of thresholds, you know, and experimentation with reality.
It does seem important to float the examples really a bit away from Stern's use of the parental maternal voice.
Oh, yes, of course.
And it's so fun, you know, all these sort of memories of psychoanalysis kind of flooding through the psyche. So it just, yeah. And then that's a good question is what, you know, how do you describe the effect, you know, in ways that don't have that kind of reference within, you know, the maternal voice that would have this deeper resonance or small sets of resonances.
Yeah, he's an early childhood psychologist, so that it does tend to get caught in that set of references. But I think you can open it up very, very easily, for example, by talking to, if you're still, for example, staying within the context of a child, simply talking about a child's relation to animals or to moving toys that move, for example, immediately brings up other fields of experience that don't necessarily get re-described in a parental structure. But I also wanted to say that the kind of description I was doing has certain risks involved that I think require almost to be complemented by the kind of work of animals that have similar kinds of structures operating in matter.
Dallas, where I was educated, was taken away from a Jewish family in 1943. My parents, for some reason, moved there, and suddenly this property is being restituted. And this can change my whole biography and memory. Now, I mention this because there is a power of the archive in the precise sense. The archive as the institution which keeps legal documents as a apparatus with rule-governed memory. Now, if I compare this to the use of the word archive by several speakers here, I wonder whether this very liberal and almost metaphorical use of the term of archive for all kinds of memory, storage, collection, library, internet, data bank, whether we don't lose the power of the archive, of the real archive, by extending it to a metaphorical term. Wouldn't it be sort of, should we not be a bit more careful in not mixing up the different memory agencies, because they have different ideological and real power over us, even the media. So, well, I don't know who wants to. Daily deliverable idea. That's what I mean. I mean, of course, we could call it
other things too. And but I think the distinction that you are agreeing on is about a kind of model. But all I'm saying is that model is not only a benign liberal model, it has been deeply liberal, and still very classic entirely. That's something to certain stuff, but that's all.
I don't know how to phrase the question, or to whom. But I try to, because there are a few elements in the different presentations that come together. So we've been talking on this element of time, just in the first question, and also a bit in the second question. The interesting thing with Apadurai, I think, is that he rephrases and in terms of anticipation, which is quite interesting because then we lose this in the session itself, which is controlled by the orientation. So, but the whole idea of, in this case, migrant populations and being oriented to the future changes the whole issue. I think that that's a very important thing. Also with Brian Sui's thing, I think the impossibility discursively or digitally to get a grip on this, what I perhaps would like to phrase as sensibility instead of rationality. But there is a reflectivity in this sensibility, which is not rational. There is a reflectivity. And my issue is, what is the reflectivity? It's not. Is new media a form of reflectivity of this sensibility? Or is this anticipation into the future a form of reflectivity of this sensibility? So that's my question, centers around this idea of breaking the rationality and the archive that in a sense is connected to it, and the identity ideologically, the identity forming powers of this archive. Can you break this idea of identity by inferring new media and techniques of new media, and for instance, the artistic effort to visualize globality? Can we enhance this sensibility by means of media, perhaps mobile phone, in the sense like Sadie was talking about it? Can we enhance this sensibility by means of something, whatever, as a result of which a new reflexivity is coming to the fore? I know it's a very broad question, but my problem is that once I make it more specific, I fall back into different discourse I want to avoid. So how can we, when we are talking about sensibility, how can we anticipate a specific reflectivity for this sensibility within the topics we are talking about?
And just to make sure I understand the question, would you say that the presentation is how you take media, make it visualizable so you can make use of material for thought, as food for thought, as food for discussion, falls within what you're talking about?
Yeah, it falls within what I'm talking about, but more in the evaluative sense than in the projective sense. The problem in the you understand what I mean probably. I think your the dispositive you disclosed for us is has an incredible value for evaluating present situations. But once you start using this statistical dispositive, and it is statistical because there's information put in a certain grid, and you use the grid to anticipate, and in a sense, you close down the possibilities by using the grid. But okay, at the other hand, within this specific dispositive, there are a lot of possibilities that are opened as well. So there is this double exposure of this dispositive. But I think you can go to this
work, which was basically about if you're an architect and you have to plan a
right.
future project.
I mean, that dispositive
is totally future oriented, right?
Right?
It's open to the future, to the possibilities. Therefore, closed by current laws, but it could be open if you transgress those laws. So I would say that
within that scope, I think it has the same potential. But within the scope, but what bothers me is the influence of statistics within this.
Would you want to tackle that, Lenny, or?
I like your general, let's say, observation, how to how you can raise sensitivity up, down, up, high. And how to make it not have dead end, but make them live the, let's say, environment useful for operations, useful. And I understand that my work has to link to my attempt, position my attempt to your framework. So I understand as well that there are limitations to this attempt. You see it as an evaluative device of current constraints. Yes, it's fine. Nevertheless, how to go beyond that is a question which is not really yet answered in my world, in the world of architecture. Up to now, to make kind of system, to develop a kind of architectural or planning system, is open or reflective, or which is, wants to push a society or push a lot of users, and it has not been given by architects. There's a maybe historical problem of concrete wood and nails that cannot simply everything is speculative or it's hypothetical. So if that is a given, then that's in my profession. Right? And it can only sometimes be overcome by fantasies, by extrapolations. Yes. They are in the frame, actually. They are within the frame of the current data. But at the moment they help to overcome the current discussions, I think it's useful. And
but is a usefulness, is it implied by leaving it behind once you have gone over the threshold?
That's one possibility. Or to already advocate for a new law, or to leave the rule or the threshold behind in order to have a viable certain area or certain location. So it starts to predict possible limitations of current law, and therefore to anticipate on that momentum for coming 5 or 10 years. Therefore, was that anticipation can already start it before the limitation is there. That's it.
Typologies, namely the fact of the appropriation of information. This is a critical aspect of all use of archives, and many archives take the information of other archives in the sense that all these different neatly classified archives actually are connected in all sorts of information flows. And in order to understand archiving, shouldn't we also ask the question of this appropriation of information among archives?
so I've just done it. But they have to be in these protection laws. But you know, what happens to these things that apparently escape, you know, what remind as a, you know, from, you know, just in later as we're starting to think about the archive, you know, what happens to all these undocumented, unrecorded things? And you know, on the one hand, I wanted to suggest that there's something almost kind of positive about the fact that these can escape the archives, and to point that out, partly with a view to making it, a sort of inevitable conclusion that no archive never should ever have the illusion of some kind of completion. And, so I think there's a bit of an undercurrent in some discourses around this kind of issue, digital archive in particular, that has this kind of deep dream of archiving everything, you know, and I wanted to try and get that, you know, maybe a, you know, perhaps a ridiculous, impossible dream, but a dangerous illusion as well. So that was really my science book. But of course, inevitably, then I got drawn down to very thinking, well, is all that implicit tacit activity some kind of implicit tacit material archive? You know, this is where I honestly am not sure what vocabulary, as I said before, one should be using. But that's my thought process, anyway.
I'm getting this, what you said, it's kind of the feeling that the idea of archive as the memory, as with history, is that we have as objective as possible, that we also learn from the past. And the more we have archives, the more we have data, something very neutral, ideally, the more we can avoid responsibility, whether it's going to the archive or surveying the archive, or neutrally analyzing the archive, analyze the archive in a way that everybody can see it in red, green, and blue, and then we see we have the objective conclusion from the archive. I think that's just a way of really avoiding responsibility. But it's also because we're confronted with so much responsibility given that there's so much data, and that always creates sort of impasse. And maybe the challenge is to really get rid of archives, to have an exploration for archives, or even exploration for history. And I mean, I don't want to say so much, but Shimon Peres says something interesting. He said that even history is all crap. And we have the wrong kind of history, because it determines our future in a way of like which battles were lost and which were not lost, etc. So even that kind of archive, which we call history, is a wrong history, is a wrong archive. And therefore will condition our future in such a way that we'll always be able to walk. I mean, that's probably clear only for the Middle East, but definitely a factor. So therefore, maybe history can be replaced by something like vision or like an invention, which again, he says, is something which humans have unique, which is one element which potentially humans from animals. So, and whenever I think of this, I think that the justifications for high nation states lies in the past, only in the past. With the exception for a few countries, maybe like Israel or the United States, which have a vision as a basis, which are not responsible to that past, except conceptually. So anyway, we need to take a vote if we are in favor of archives.
If I may add one more thing, because I suppose what the issue here is the cognitive value of the data in the archives, whether archives contain the truth, for instance, or whether they contain factual data that corresponds with reality. And I would have to add that in general, data doesn't contain anything. It is the explanations of data, whether it's via models, via theories, and so on, which eventually give us some kind of grasp on reality. So when you have lots of historical data, but you don't have a historical model, say of social dynamics, or of economic dynamics, or of sociological dynamics, which explains the data, which gives you some kind of explanation of why the data is this way and not that way, without that explanation, without answers to why questions, why is the data this way, why is the fact, why were the facts, but we don't really have knowledge, so we should probably not think about archives as depositories of knowledge itself, or rather as intermediate steps together with explanatory models can
discerning these very subtle differences